to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. You've probably seen people in TV and movies rummaging through people's trash in order to try to divine their secrets. A fictional depiction of paparazzi rummaging through a celebrity's garbage in order to try to find out more about them. Well, that's rather frivolous. There is a serious, much more serious study of garbage, and Dr. William Rathje is among those who makes it his business to understand the archaeology of garbage. He's going to be talking about the subject from 6 to 7 p.m. in the Tennessee Room of the James Union Building on November the 2nd here at MTSU as part of the Undergraduate Social Science Symposium. He's going to be talking about our garbage dilemma from the perspective of an anthropologist. And here with us on the telephone, the author of Rubbish, the Archaeology of Garbage, is Dr. William Rathje. Bill, thanks for being with us today.
Well, I'm very pleased to be with you.
How did you come to be interested in this particular subject?
Well, all archaeologists study garbage. Ours is just fresher than most. And, you know, the timeline of what was considered legitimate archaeological data has changed so much over time. It used to be a couple hundred years, then it got down to 100 years, then 50 years, which is what it's at legally right now. But I figured, hey, in 50 years, the garbage we've been throwing away is going to be archaeological if we can find important information out about societies from their garbage. Why wait to dig it up? Why not study it now so we have a better handle on what's going on in our own society?
How did ancient cultures dispose of their rubbish? How did ancient cultures dispose of their rubbish?
In most cases, they would just throw it out behind their houses or in large dumps that were usually downwind, which makes them very easy for archaeologists to find. And that was about it. In some cases, the garbage was burned. And in fact, our term for hell comes from the Valley of Gehenna, where the Middle East, where garbage was thrown into open methane vents that were coming up out of the ground that were on fire, and the garbage was thrown in to be burned.
How and when did societies start to determine that they needed to dispose of their garbage in a more sanitary manner?
As soon as they settled down. For the first million or so years, the solution to garbage was simply when it got too deep, you move. You know, you throw it out around your camp, and then, and then when there's too much of it, you just move on to your next hunting and gathering site.
So when you can't stand the stench anymore, you just move.
Farming and staying in one place, they realized that the garbage had to be moved.
And so
that was about, in the Near East, about 10,000 years B.C.
So they would just pick up bag and baggage, and instead of putting it in landfills or burning it or whatever, they just change residences.
That's right. Back before 10,000 B.C., that's what they used to do. They just move.
Well, they say one man's trash is another man's treasure. How has the way we decide what is trash and what is keepable changed over the millennia?
Well, I think the most important thing to point out is that there have always been scavengers and people who sort through the garbage that a society throws out to pick out what they think might be useful. So there's always been recycling and reuse for as long as there have been garbage dumps. And it's been very interesting to see that the more garbage we throw away, the more we figure out that we can use a lot of it in new ways through recycling and reuse.
Is the garbage that we throw away today longer lasting than the garbage of yesteryear? Is more of it non-biodegradable?
Well, we really don't know the answer to that yet, because there have only been landfills around for 50 years. Before that, most of the garbage was thrown out into open dumps, which generated methane gas in biodegradation and then burned. And most of that is ash and glass and metal and so forth, not a lot of material. But today, we bury the garbage, most of it, in landfills, and those landfills are kept dry so that they won't leak what's called leachate, which can have hazardous components in it. And when we first dug down into those dry landfills, which really began being built after World War II, we found that newspapers were still readable from the 1940s. And, I don't mean a piece of newspaper. I mean a whole newspaper with many pages and ads and headlines, and they're still there. And in fact, paper has been the largest growing item in landfills since we began landfilling materials, and it doesn't biodegrade much at all. So there's not a lot of change in that, and paper represents 40 to 50% of what's in landfills.
How do you
plastic, which is everybody's favorite environmental villain, excuse me again, it doesn't biodegrade either, but it does degrade. In other words, it dries out and it breaks up into tiny pieces. And plastic represents about 16 to 20% of what's in our landfills. And then after that, it's smaller percentages of metal and glass and food debris. That about half the food debris will biodegrade in the first 15 years, and then the other half stabilizes, and don't get much change in it. And then there are tires and all sorts of other things, but the big components are, and construction and demolition debris, concrete, rebar, wallboard, stuff like that doesn't biodegrade very well, and that makes up at least 20% of what's in landfills, maybe more.
Is that an argument for building with more biodegradable materials?
No, because once you put it in a landfill, the biodegradation doesn't work very well. Because in order to have biodegradation work, you have to have moisture, you have to have the right microorganisms, and you have to have movement of that moisture. In other words, you have to have circulation. And if you don't have those things, which you don't have in modern dry landfills, you're not going to get much biodegradation of anything. For example, there are a lot of environmental groups who have credit cards, and they make it out of what they call biodegradable plastic. Well, if you put it in a composting facility, it will biodegrade. if you throw it into your regular garbage and it goes to a landfill, it won't.
Why are we as a society seemingly reluctant to invest in curbside recycling on a massive scale? Is it just too time-consuming to separate the materials?
Well, there's been a change in that over time, especially after Earth Day in the 1970s, and there are a lot of states where curbside recycling is mandatory, like New York State, California, a couple of others. But in addition to that, there are a lot of large cities and large towns that have adopted curbside recycling. What we find that's interesting is that the separation of recyclable versus non-recyclable garbage is not very good. In fact, when we collect and sort both the bags of recyclables that people put out for collection and their normal trash they put out for collection, if you find an aluminum can in the recyclable bag, you're almost bound to find at least one or two aluminum cans in the garbage. I mean, people just aren't very careful about how they sort it out. And that's why an awful lot of recyclable garbage that's collected as recyclable only goes to what are called MRFs, or materials recycling facilities. And what happens there is the recyclables are dumped out on a conveyor belt and people pick through it as it goes down the line and pull out the stuff that isn't recyclable and separate the stuff that is, the aluminum, the paper, etc.
Now, your mentioning of the aluminum can reminded me about what a friend of mine from Alabama used to say about garbage. It was how he defined the term good old boy versus redneck, how you could tell the difference. And he said,
I don't know. Tell me.
Well, he said, a redneck is a guy who just throws his beer cans out by the side of the road, and a good old boy is a guy who takes all of his empty beer cans and puts them in the back of his pickup truck and takes them down either to the garbage dump or the recycling center. So
I think that's a pretty good definition, but also in the cities that we've studied, Tucson, the San Francisco Bay Area, the Chicago area, New York City, Florida, what we find is that lower-income populations tend to recycle a lot, especially their aluminum cans, a lot more consistently than high-income and middle-income areas because the cans are valuable. And so you get a lot of recycling going on in those neighborhoods, but you get a lot more people in the middle and upper income neighborhoods who say they recycle all their aluminum cans. So what we find is our major conclusion by sorting through fresh garbage is what people say they do and what they actually do based on what they throw away can be very different things. You know, if you ask people how much beer they drink, for example, you'll find out that by their accounts, by their reports, about 40% of the beer that's brewed in America and imported into America isn't consumed by anybody. It's in some warehouse in St. Louis. Now, obviously, that's not the case. I mean, and obviously people are drastically underreporting the amount of beer they consume, but there's an interesting difference between Anglo reporters and Hispanic reporters. Hispanic reporters, if they say they drink beer, they're going to be very accurate. If they say they don't drink beer, you don't know whether they do or not. They'll just totally non-report. Whereas Anglos, almost all of Anglos or whites, underreport how much they drink. And the same is true, of course, of how much health food they buy, and all sorts of other kinds of behaviors. If it's a positive behavior in their minds, they'll overreport it. If it's negative, they'll underreport it.
That leads me to bring up something about green jobs. One of our professors in political science is very much an activist in trying to help minorities and marginalized peoples in society help dig themselves out of poverty with green jobs. So given what you've said about minorities, particularly Hispanics, could there be a very bright future in garbage for some of the more marginalized members of society in helping them to...
Absolutely true. You know, the early cities in the United States, you know, Ben Franklin was the first person who sort of invented garbage pickup. And from then on, excuse me again, almost every city had a minority that was very much involved in the garbage pickup. Italians, Hispanics, you name the minority, and there's some place where they've got a niche in refuse collection, which is not a bad business. It's a good business. It does good things for the environment in most cases, and you can also make some money at it. So it's a good thing to be in. In Tucson, Arizona, where I live, I think about 70% of the can tossers, as they call themselves, are Hispanic.
Do most municipalities or governmental entities employ their own sanitation workers to pick up the garbage, or do they contract it out with the private sector?
It's about 50-50. You get about half the communities that have their own sanitation department or division, and you get about half the contract with people like Waste Management or BFI or Laidlaw or some private company. But it's about 50-50. And just to give you an example, in Tucson, Arizona, garbage in the city is picked up by city sanitation. Garbage in the county is picked up by private haulers.
I can remember back in the 60s and 70s when the sanitation workers in New York City would threaten to go on strike. It would darn near shut down the town. It can be serious business.
Well, that's very true. You're dealing with a very, very, very important commodity, and it's important for most people to get it out of sight. And so a sanitation strike, I remember being in New York City during one of the sanitation strikes, and you don't have yards in most cases to put the garbage in, so the garbage is just lined up on the sidewalk, so there's only a really small path for people to walk by, and then the rest of the sidewalk is covered by huge mounds of bags of garbage. So it's a very critical resource. Now, in the United States, we have a saying about garbage, and that is out of sight, out of mind. And I think that's dead wrong. And the reason I say that is because there's always garbage somewhere around you. I would be willing to take a small bet that you have a garbage can near you, Ms. Logue. Right?
At the moment, I'm looking around the studio, and I don't see one, but I'm sure there's at least a small one under the desk. Oh, in my office? Certainly, definitely.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There are garbage cans and receptacles all over the place. There's, I'm afraid, more litter than we would like to see all over the place. So garbage is really insight out of mind. We just don't want to pay attention to it.
It's because...
Although some cities now, like Chicago and a few others, have very decorative garbage containers in the shape of animals or pretty painted cans or things like that.
It's become something of a canard to call ourselves the disposable society. Kleenexes instead of handkerchiefs, I guess, would be one example. But there are so many examples of when you're done with it, just toss it, throw it away, that our pre-20th century forebears did not have at their disposal. Do you think we are the most disposable society ever in that way?
No.
Who was more disposable than we are?
Lots of societies throw away lots of stuff that can still be used, and they have ceremonies where they break decorative pottery and throw it away. And I'm a Maya archaeologist originally, and the Maya used to take jade pendants and necklaces and things like that and put them on an altar and smash them with stones and then burn them. So I think one of my archaeology colleagues said that the people who lived at Altun Ha in Yucatan Peninsula, he said, they're the kind of people that if they bought a Cadillac, they'd trade it in when they filled up the ashtrays. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we realize exactly how much we really do reuse. Do you know what the number one export is in the United States?
No, what is it?
Scrap metal. From cars, from refrigerators, stoves, and other durables, from various appliances. And all that stuff is exported and is one of the reasons that our trade balance isn't any worse than it already is. And then also our second largest import is paper. Newspapers and scrap paper and stuff like that. Because in countries like Japan, for example, there aren't a lot of trees that people can cut down and make into paper products. So they import our waste paper to make their new paper. So if you go to Japan and you pick up a newspaper or a comic book, it's gray. And the reason is because it's hard to get all the ink out. So they just have the recycled paper from the U.S., which is gray. And I also remember going to Mexico and giving a talk and showing pictures of all the paper that we threw away, and they kept saying, oh, que rico, you know, how rich that garbage is. And there's an irony here. In 1987, when the garbage barge sailed, I think most people thought that it was hazardous waste, and that's why no one would take it. The irony is that most of the 3,000 tons of garbage on the garbage barge that couldn't find any place to get dumped was white office paper, which is highly recyclable and very valuable. So it could have been sold at something like $45 a ton, which is not, not that bad a deal.
If I could go back to the Mayans for a second, what was the significance of the jade smashing ritual?
We don't know. I mean, I should say Maya archaeologists don't know. I haven't been one in a long time, but nobody really understands why they did that. But in a lot of societies, and in the Maya, you know, they would have these big feasts in honor of particular gods. And then when they were over, they would take the decorated pottery and other decorated items, jewelry, etc., and smash it and burn it as a tribute to the gods. That's all I can think of that it, it wasn't that they were trying to get rid of the jade. It was that it was an offering to the gods, and you can either bury it, which the Maya did all the time, in caches in front of temples, in the middle of the steps of temples, in burials, etc., or you can smash and burn it in public where everybody sees how much valuable stuff you're giving to the gods.
Your mentioning scrap metal reminded me of World War II, when there were neighborhood scrap metal drives, rubber drives, donate your nylon drives.
Well, let me tell you something sad about that. I was very interested in especially the tire drives, because you had to, when you went in to get a new tire, you had to turn your old tires in. And I was in England, and there was a lady there who'd done a dissertation on the tires that were collected in England. And many of them were not used during the war and ended up being thrown away. And the same thing happened in the United States. And I wrote an essay on that in MSW Management Magazine, a garbage magazine. And I got a letter from a guy who said, you know, I couldn't believe that, except that I was traveling on a train to Florida, and once we got into Florida, for about 50 miles, there were piles of tires on either side of the train. And I asked about them, and was told by the conductor that they came from World War II.
So the rubber never got used.
We're pretty good at collecting things when there's a good reason, but we're not always so good at the logistics of recycling.
What do you think the future holds for the examination and recycling of garbage?
Well, I think in all aspects of garbage, the answer is picking up. It's going to pick up. There's going to be a lot more interesting garbage, a lot more recycling, a lot more studying garbage to find out what we have so we can make better use of it, more environmental use of it, and not create so many environmental hazards. You know, batteries used to contain a lot of lead, I mean household batteries, and now that's been replaced. And when we dug into landfills, we found high levels of lead in almost every sample that we dug up. And the only item that was in every sample was newspapers. And, of course, the newspapers were, for a long time, made with lead-based inks. And I gave a talk at the National Newspaper Publishers Association and brought this up, and the next year they passed sort of a general suggestion to everybody to switch to non-lead based inks. And in the years after that, in the levels that we dug up from landfills, the lead levels declined significantly.
That's pretty amazing, and perhaps a cautionary tale for the future. Dr. William Rathje will speak on Our Garbage Dilemma from the Perspective of an Anthropologist at the Undergraduate Social Science Symposium, November 2nd, in the Tennessee Room of the JUB James Union Building on the MTSU campus from 6 to 7 p.m. His talk and his book, Rubbish, the Archaeology of Garbage, are both personally endorsed by Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street. Thanks, Dr. Rathje, for being with us today, and we'll welcome you to campus when you get here.
Well, I thank you, and I look forward to seeing the students.
Yes.
Meeting the students.
And you'll meet a lot of them, I'm sure.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.